This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello, hello, hello. Hi there. I can't see you, but you can see me. This seems appropriate. My name is Avi Lewis. Welcome once again to the luscious Lenzik Performing Arts Center, home lo these many years to an immovable feast of literary delights, in which you get to luxuriate, you lucky sods, simply because the Lannan Foundation loves you and is committed to your unending intellectual sustenance. And you should applaud. This is not the first time I've had the opportunity to share this stage with a great writer in the In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom series. And I have to say, for an interviewer, this is actually like the greatest gig on earth. A sumptuous, soft-seater, an audience that is well-read, well-dressed, open-minded, most of whom have spent the hours before showtime in enthusiastic exploration of the bar. You, sir. I have deeply enjoyed my previous evenings here, basking in the radical charm of Arundhati Roy, jousting with Chuck Bodin and his irascible, armor-piercing wit, soaking up the anecdotes of the great raconteur Tariq Ali. I've had a good run. Of course, I am a mere interloper here to compare to the great and greatly beloved Amy Goodman, who by my count has held court here no fewer than a dozen times, and David Barsamian, of course, America's foremost compulsive interviewer. Seriously, you get in an elevator with that guy and you have divulged your deepest secrets before the next floor. David has me well in the rearview mirror with at least 8 Lenzik notches on his microphone. And don't even get me started on that guy, Michael Silverblatt, who has been blessed to stand here before you more than 20 times. My naked envy, as unseemly as it is, I think, entirely justified. No matter when you come to a Lannan event in Santa Fe, you are sure to be graced with a conversation that will tickle your brain, enliven your outrage, and dump you onto the street afterwards with mind, heart, and conversation racing. Now, I don't just say this to reinforce your Santa Fean solipsism. Despite appearances, you are not the center of the intellectual world. But thanks to the Lannan Foundation, you are pretty damn close. And tonight, if we do our jobs right, we'll bring you a little bit closer. With all of the luminaries who come through here twinkling in the background, I hope no one will be offended when I confess that I'm most excited about our guest tonight. I have the honor of warming up this magnificent piece of lucite for Greg Grandin, who is here for the very first time. And I think we ought to show him a quick pre-welcome, because by day, a mild-mannered professor of history at NYU, by night, a mild-mannered author of life-changing works of nonfiction, Greg is possessed of a talent that is anything but mild. As many of you know from his frequent appearances on Democracy Now!, Greg is known for his expertise on the history of Latin America, particularly on the role of the United States in the life of our neighbors to the south. For those of you who are new to Greg's work, let me share my own sort of whirlwind highlights reel of his recent books. And for the many Grandinites in the audience, you know who you are, this will be just a mere brush-up. Empire's Workshop, though not his first major work by any means, was a breakthrough book. Published in 2007 in the twilight of the Bush era, it was nothing short of revelatory. For many of us who at that time were fervently following the pink tide of leftish governments in Latin America, the experience was like reading by the light of a candle when someone walks into the room and flicks on the floodlights. Greg demonstrated that the United States has not just treated Latin America as a big backyard over the last 200 years, but rather that Latin America has served as a laboratory, test kitchen, and proving ground for the entire apparatus of American empire. From refining counterinsurgency military tactics, to testing Milton Friedman economics, to waging war in the name of spreading democracy, to cementing domestic coalitions here in the United States of evangelicals and neocons, or neoliberals, as we call them now, through the development of soft power, the resurgence of hard power, the rise of the doctrine of preemptive warfare, Latin America was where the United States literally became an empire in every sense of the word. And Greg helped us understand that in an exhaustive way. He showed how a study of Reagan's dirty wars was an indispensable primer for understanding the Bush-Cheney global war. And in the process, he gave us the tools to understand what was going on at that pivotal moment, both in Latin America and in the U.S. empire writ large, which is to say, he gave us the tools to take apart the official story and to strip away some of its power. Greg followed Empire's workshop with a Pulitzer Prize finalist, a book called Fordlandia. It is a brilliant work of historical research and a stunning piece of storytelling. It's the entirely surreal tale of Henry Ford's hubristic adventure as he tried and spectacularly failed to build a corporate utopia in the rainforest of the Brazilian Amazon. On the surface, it was a rubber plantation. But as Greg skillfully reveals, Ford conceived of it as nothing less than a privatized model society, embedded in every detail with the paternalistic, Puritan, and worker-exploiting vision that is rightly associated with that great name of American capitalism. And as the tale of a grand disaster, it also documents the many failures of the ideology that spawned it. In his latest work, The Empire of Necessity, Greg takes a deep look at a single remarkable story, a slave revolt at the turn of the 19th century that ended in a life-and-death theatrical shipboard performance. No spoilers from me. I will leave it to Greg to tell you more. But what's striking about the book is how he relentlessly tracks down every revealing detail about the many characters in this sprawling drama, and in the process weaves a gripping story that leads the reader with great subtlety to a deeper understanding of our entire modern world. It's no surprise that Greg is both a beloved and best-selling author, despite being a hugely admired academic. His powers of historical sleuthing are legendary, and his writing is entirely unafflicted by the jargon and self-impressed density of much academic prose. Bottom line is, he is a master of narrative. And this is what takes his skill as an historian and elevates him to the kind of writer who can change your life. And it's that quality that I have come to love and value so deeply about Greg's work. Over the last 4 years, I've been working on a book and film project about the economic roots of the climate crisis. And what has become really clear to me in this long research project, in looking at the unsustainable, hell, the suicidal system that we live in, is that we are made of stories, driven by stories. We are living and dying our stories. Our stories make us. And if we don't change them, they will break us. All our systems, from our economy and our culture to the way we make energy and deal with waste, are based on narratives that are baked into us from earliest childhood. Stories that celebrate domination of nature, of other people, of other peoples. Stories of endless frontiers, boundless benevolent technologies that save the day at the last minute, resources consumed with abandon and no limits. If we want to change course before our system drives us all off the cliff, we must change our stories. We need to transform the cultural narratives that underpin every aspect of our disastrously failing system. And that's why Greg, for my money, is one of the most important voices of our time, particularly for citizens of the Americas. By telling the true tales of our past, by tracing the narratives that have formed it, by digging deep into the foundations of the present, he holds out to us a trailing bundle of stories. It's our job to grab hold and yank them up by the roots. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Grandin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Avi, for that really lovely, lovely introduction. It's really an honor to be here on the stage with somebody whose work I respect so much. I show the take in every class that I teach, no matter what it's about. I make my students watch the take. And it's wonderful to be here at the Lannan Foundation and in this wonderful theater and be part of this great project of political literacy. And I just want to thank you for inviting me. So in 1855, Herman Melville wrote an otherworldly novella. It was nominally set on a Spanish slave ship in the remote South Pacific, but it really took place in the mind of the master class. Not the slave-owning master class of antebellum America. In Melville's rendition of Amasa Delano, around whom events in the story circulate, Delano is a modernizer. He's a modern man. He's a new man of the American Revolution. He embodies a cheery optimism about the world. He sees himself as opposed to slavery in both practice and in lore and in sensibility. He believes himself an egalitarian. The story was called is called Benito Sereno, and it was published at a very consequential moment in Melville and the nation's life. As I mentioned, it was 1855. It was a few years after the publication and appearance of Moby Dick, and a few years before the oncoming Civil War, the launch of the Civil War. It was just as a moment that Herman Melville himself broke down physically and emotionally. We think of Moby Dick now as the American novel. But at the time, it was roundly panned. Critics, it didn't sell. Critics thought it was, at best, an indication of Melville's irrelevance, or at worst, an indication of his madness and his lunacy. And then, of course, Benito Sereno was coming right before the Civil War, a moment of deep despair, when people of Melville's generation thought that there was no exit from the crisis that the trafficking in human bodies in the South and slavery, chattel slavery, had brought upon the nation, that there would only be really two options. One is to confront slavery head on, and that would lead to the destruction of the nation. This experiment in liberty that was the American Republic, or let slavery be and accept the fact that freedom for some, liberties for some, meant enslavement of others, a very limited notion of freedom. And in a way, Benito Sereno captures that dilemma and that despair like no other piece of work in American literature. As I mentioned, it takes place in the South Pacific. And a good contrast is with Moby Dick, and in terms of form and style. Moby Dick is the sprawling, generous, capacious novel that takes place over a number of different oceans and brings together peoples of all races in a novel that has a catastrophic ending but is joyous in a lot of its prose. Benito Sereno is the exact opposite in form. It's compressed and condensed into one day on one ship and then into one mind, into Amasa Delano's mind. Nothing much happens in the story. It all takes place largely through Amasa Delano's point of view. Melville tells the story from Amasa Delano's perspective. He boards this slave ship that he comes across. He's in the South Pacific sealing on his ship, and he comes across this distressed vessel that has tattered sails. Its hull is calcified. It's trailing a long garland of seagrass. It looks very haunting and spooky. It's a strange ship. And Delano boards it, and he spends all day on board the ship. And events conspire that he's left alone. He sends his own men to a remote island, a nearby island, to fill up the water casks and to fetch back some food. And he spends all day by himself watching the workings of what he thinks is a normally functioning, a distressed but normally functioning slave ship. There's dozens of West African men and women and a few children. There's a handful of Spaniards. And then there's the man who introduces himself as Captain, Benito Sereno, who is tended to and waited on by a man named Babo. Is introduced as his black body servant, his slave. And Delano becomes increasingly obsessed with the relationship between the two men. Sereno grows increasingly vacant and unresponsive. Delano watches as Babo tends to him, wipes spittle from his mouth, holds him up, shaves him. And he knows something's wrong, but he can't quite figure out what it is. And it's revealed about two-thirds into the story, towards the end, when it's revealed to Delano, the character, that things aren't as they seem, that the slaves aren't slaves or the West Africans aren't slaves, that they're actually running things, that they're choreographing this whole scene, this whole spectacular, that they had risen up months earlier, seized the ship, killed most of the Spaniards, including the slaver who was taking them to Lima to be sold, and demanded to be returned to Senegal. Melville tells the story in a series of flashbacks, and it's revealed that Benito Sereno, the Spanish captain, stalled. He sailed first up and down the coast of Chile, trying to avoid having to round Cape Horn, and which would have been very dangerous. Delano doesn't realize any of this. He can't see that it's choreographed. So I assigned this book. I assigned this book to my classes. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was preparing to teach it. And I was teaching it as a kind of illustration of Anglo attitudes toward Spaniards and Spaniards' attitudes toward Anglo, and how it was mediated through this institution of slavery, how we can think about slavery as an institution that was Pan-American in scope and it wasn't just based in the United States as we often think of slavery. And I was reading a footnote of a secondary book, a literary theorist that I was preparing for the class, and the footnote mentioned that the story was all true, that it was that Melville got the story from the memoirs of a real historical person, a sea captain named Amasa Delano. And I remember staring at that footnote for quite a while. I was literally dumbstruck. I mean, it was kind of like being told that that Ridley Scott's Alien was true. In a lot of ways, the structures of the story are the same, that you know there's evil on board, you know it's lurking somewhere, you don't know what until this big explosive ending in which the reality is revealed. And also, even beyond the structure, it was uncanny. How could this group of West Africans have pulled off this deception in the middle of the South Pacific? And how could they have tricked an experienced mariner? It turns out Amasa Delano, the real historic Amasa Delano, was a distant descendant of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from a not particularly successful branch of the Delano family and from Massachusetts, and he was an experienced sailor. He had circumnavigated. He was in the middle of his third circumnavigation of the globe. He liked to think of himself as a man of the world who could see the world as it was, and a practical man. And yet he fell prey to this elaborately staged con, a nine-hour full cast pantomime of the master slave relation. It was quite a remarkable story. And so I started doing some more research on it. I read Delano's memoir. So when I say that Melville based the story on Delano's memoir and it's a true story, it's not true the way Moby Dick is true. Moby Dick is true in the sense that it's drawn a little bit from the actual stoving of the whale ship Essex by an enraged whale. But Melville drew as much from King Lear, from Shakespeare's King Lear, from Milton's Paradise Lost, from all of these great epics in world literature of rebellion and arrogance and hubris. Benito Sereno, it turns out, is remarkably faithful to Chapter 18 of Amasa Delano's memoir. It's just almost a literal, almost transcriptural in chronological terms. Melville fills in the atmosphere, and his addition, the value added, is how he's able to enter the mind of a New England Yankee who understands himself as modern and understands himself as a reformer, and tap into and reveal this kind of new kind of racism, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But the events are remarkably similar, to the point where when Melville actually reproduces all of these legal documents that Delano has in his memoir. It was very opaque in his motives. For pretty much all of his writings, but particularly Benito Sereno, we're not really sure why or what it was that drew him to the memoir. We don't have the copy that he read. We don't have an annotated version of Amasa Delano's memoir with Melville's underlinings like we do about a lot of other texts. But I don't think it's that hard to understand what it was that drew him to the event. In the historical Delano's retelling of it, it has the triangular symmetry of a play and the psychological and historical depth of a Greek epic, a Greek drama. Homer's Odyssey is not about slavery, but it does tell of a character, Odysseus, who many scholars think represents the first modern man. By that they mean that he had the ability to use his inner thoughts and his inner life and his cunning to manipulate reality, to kind of create a schism between appearance and content, between
between surface and substance. I am nobody, Odysseus says, playing with the subtleties of language in order to gull the Cyclops. And that, in many ways, is exactly what Babo, in Melville's retelling of the story, does, and the rest of the slave rebel troop try to do to escape Delano. They act as if they're inconsequential slaves. Nobody's hardly worth noticing. Now, aside from its sheer audacity, what is most fascinating about the ruse is how it exposes a larger falsehood, a larger deception, on which the whole ideological edifice of slavery rested. The idea that slaves were loyal and simple-minded, people who had no independent lives or thoughts, no inner lives. And if they did have an interior self, that too was within the jurisdiction of their master. That too was property. What you saw on the outside was no different from what there was on the inside. The West Africans used talents their masters said they didn't have, cunning, reason, guile, discipline, to give lie to the stereotypes of what they were said to be, loyal, simple-minded, and faithful. And they did so under extreme circumstances. I'm talking about the real historical West Africans now. They were exhausted and they were dying. Over the course of nearly 2 years from when they were first taken out of their homes in West Africa, many of them were Muslim. They had tracked their journey across half the world from West Africa into the Pacific by following the Islamic lunar calendar. They were brought first into Montevideo in Buenos Aires, that great sea gulf that is in southern South America. They got caught up in the wheels of corruption and contraband, and they were transformed into commodities. Then they were marched. You know, most histories and most stories and what we know about slavery, we think of the Middle Passage, and we think the terrors of the journey are ending more or less when they reach the shores of the Americas. In this case, they continued onward. They were marched across the Pampas, the impossibly flat Pampas, across the whole of the American continent, then up over the Andes, the tallest point of the Andes, under the shadow of the highest mountain in the Americas, and then down into the Pacific. And they were put back on another ship, Benito Cedeño's trial. That was the name of the trial. Macedelano's ship was called the Perseverance. Benito Cedeño's ship was called the Trial, on their way to Lima, to be sold in the market. And then they rose up. They rose up on the holiest day of Ramadan, the night of power, the day that the angel Gabriel began to reveal the verses of the Quran to Muhammad. They slaughtered most of the Spaniards, including their slaver, and they demanded to be returned to Senegal, to West Africa. But then, after nearly 2 months sailing in the Pacific, up and down, with water and food running out, the rush of power that came from their uprising had fallen away into desperation. Two women died of dehydration. Two children also died of dehydration by the time Delano boarded the ship. So it must have required enormous self-control to resist the temptation to either fight or surrender, to do anything they needed to get water and food. But they did. They managed to summon up this incredible inner resources and reserve in order to shed the trappings of freedom, which in any case had proven elusive with every day they were adrift in the South Pacific, and assume the roles of slaves. And in doing so, in some ways, they embraced a deeper meaning of freedom, the ability to kind of control their inner appetites and their inner passions and to manipulate reality. And to perform this remarkable pantomime. It was only late in the afternoon, at around 4 o'clock, that the slave who was playing the role of loyal servant to Benito Cedeño, in real life his name was Mori. Babo was Mori's father, and they were the organizers of this deception and the previous revolt, felt a flush of pride for having. Gulled the Cyclops for over 9 hours. When Delano climbed off of his boat, still unsure what exactly was going on between the slaves and Benito Cedeño and why Benito Cedeño was treating him with such distance and such coldness, he climbs down the rope ladder into his boat. His men are just pushing off of the hull to row back to the Perseverance. Maury, feeling the kind of rush of pride of having pulled this off, says to Benito Cereño, how many men are on board his ship? And when he's told, he said, well, it'll only take us a few hours to seize the ship and take its provisions, and then you'll be captain of not just this ship, but also his ship. At that moment, Benito Cedeño realizes that there's not going to be any end to his ordeal, and it snaps him out of his stupor, and he pitches himself over the side of the ship, and he lands at the bottom, at the feet of the Masa Delano, in his boat. And it's at that moment that Delano, after a bit of confusion and interpretation, realizes just the depth of his deception. Melville does a great kind of rendition of that moment, you know, having the scales fall from his eyes. He sees the Negroes for what they really are. And then Delano, realizing the depths of his deception, begins to mobilize his men to put down the rebellion and take back the ship and re-enslave the West African rebel actors with a particular horrific violence. So the theme of this lecture that I'm honored to be part of is In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, this lecture series. And I think there's no more powerful exposition of freedom than the German philosopher Hegel's famous master-slave allegory from the early 1800s. The German philosopher begins his description of the master-slave relation with the master believing that he is a sovereign consciousness, independent, existing prior and independent and superior to the slave in his possession, even as he grows materially and psychically dependent on his slave. Soon the solipsism of the master gives way to an acute, to an intense awareness of the slave's being, so much so that he can't imagine a world without him. He comes to realize his utter dependence on the slave, not just on his labor, but on the slave's recognition of his existence. And in turn, as the slave becomes aware of this interdependence, of this dependence, the slave begins to realize his or her equality, as it would be. Hegel's allegory has been called an existential impasse, but it's not really an impasse, since there is an exit. It's not a Beckett play. The whole point of Hegel's parable is to identify how human consciousness evolves to a next level, how it moves towards a higher register of freedom, how it pursues freedom. And it's out of the struggle between the master and the slave that a new world consciousness emerges. Hegel says elsewhere, it wasn't so much from slavery as through slavery that humanity was emancipated. And that's what's so fascinating about this historical encounter on the Pacific, which, by the way, is taking place almost at the same time as Hegel is composing the master-slave dialectic back in Germany. So you have, on the one hand, you have Hegel writing in Germany. On the other hand, you're seeing this performance of the master-slave dialectic by this group of West Africans, about as far away from Germany as you can imagine in the South Pacific. What's so fascinating about it, though, except it's not a duo, what's going on the trial. It's not a master and slave. There's a third person involved. There's a witness to the dialectic. But the witness, Amasa Delano, is too dense to understand what he's witnessing. And one wonders what exactly, in Melville's hand, how Amasa Delano becomes proxy for the United States. What did it mean that not so much that the United States was embroiled in slavery, but it couldn't even see the terms of its own embeddedness? So in the research that I did, two narrative arcs come out, and that basically is the structure of the book. One traces the West Africans, the story of the West Africans, across the Atlantic and into Montevideo and into Buenos Aires and across the Americas and into the Pacific. The other one follows Amasa Delano on his journeys, and what brings him into the Pacific. And what brings him into the Pacific, which I'll talk a little bit later, is sealing. And their encounter and their clash and the crashing together of these two narratives is the point where a kind of ecological violence associated with resource extraction crashes into the race terror associated with slavery. And it gives us a way of seeing how those two things are interrelated. It uses that event to explore what the great historian of slavery, Edmund Morgan, in the 1970s called the paradox of freedom and slavery in the Americas, the ways in which freedom was dependent on and defined by slavery in all sorts of ways. when Morgan was looking specifically at colonial Virginia, this story that I try to tell looks at the paradox in all of the Americas, north and in south, the Atlantic to the Pacific. So when we think of slavery in America, we usually tend to think of the explosion of slavery that happened after the War of 1812 with the British, after the push into the West, the opening up of the Mississippi, the Louisiana Purchase, the move into Texas, and the cotton lands of the Mississippi, as recently enacted in the very vivid movie 12 Years a Slave, that terrorist system that emerges in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, up to when Melville writes Benito Sereno. But what was happening in the United States was really the last stage of a much more diffused and dispersed explosion. It began in the Caribbean in the 1770s, moved down to Brazil, then Spanish South America, and only reaching the United States until much later. It was starting around the 1770s. Slavery obviously existed throughout all of the Americas since the Spaniards arrived in the and brought the first slaves and first slave ship in the early 1500s. But for centuries, it was a tightly controlled economy. The Spaniards regulated it through a system that they called mercantilism. They limited the number of ports. Only Cartagena and Havana and a few other Spanish ports were allowed to bring in a quota, a limited number of slaves. Only a few monopoly companies or corporations had the right to import slaves. Only a few select, very well-connected merchants had the right to preside over the slave trade domestically. But beginning in the 1770s, Spain begins to unravel. I mean, to use terms that we would associate with today, they deregulated, they privatized the slave trade. And they were very clear about what they were doing. They were instituting what they called free trade in blacks. And Spanish American merchants were demanding more liberty, and what they meant by that was more liberty to be able to buy and sell Africans, to be able to sail to Africa, buy slaves, and bring them back into the Americas. And almost there's almost a kind of tick-tock between every burst of revolutionary ardor during the Age of Liberty, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the execution of Louis and Marie Antoinette in France. Every one of these kind of revolutionary moments, Haiti declaring independence, was almost followed almost within months of Spain further deregulating the slave trade, lowering taxes, lowering tariffs, allowing individuals to sail to Africa to use their own ships, opening up ports like Montevideo and Buenos Aires, in which slaves, only a few limited number of slaves were allowed to be brought in. It really was a free-for-all. More slaves came into Montevideo in 1803. And again, 1803 is a moment where slavery in the United States is largely thought to be on its way out, and certainly in the North, and a lot of people even thought in the South. More slaves came into Montevideo in 1803 than any year previously. It was a free-for-all. Slaves were involved in almost every aspect of what historians call the market revolution, the capitalist revolution of the Atlantic world, which basically created the modern world, the modern institutions, the laws, the economics that we live with. Enslaved Africans and African Americans slaughtered cattle, they sheared wool, they spun cotton, they wove cloth in workshops in Mexico City, they planted coffee, they boiled Peruvian sugar to make candy. In Ecuador, they made the ships, which were used to bring in more slaves. They were laborers, bakers, brickmakers, liverymen, cobblers, carpenters, tanners, smiths, blacksmiths, rag pickers, cooks, and servants. And it wasn't just the labor that spurred the commercialization of society. The driving of more slaves inland, just like these slaves were in 1803, and across the continent, opened up new routes and expanded old ones. It tied hinterland markets and created new circuits of finance and trade. Historians debate about the role his slave labor played in the making of capitalism, but slaves were much more than labor. They were the flywheel of the market revolution. They were obviously labor. They were investments. They were purchased and rented out. They were credit used to secure loans. They were property. They were commodities. They were capital. They literally made money. Slaves in the mints of Lima trampled quicksilver mercury into silver in order to amalgamate the silver, pressing the toxic poison of mercury into their bloodstream. making the coins, which began to monetarize society. But they also were money. In a lot of places that were cast short, they slaves were the standard on which other goods were valued. But slavery wasn't just an economic institution. It was an emotional and psychic one as well. And there was a deep emotional investment in slavery. For a declining aristocracy, slaves who were kind of losing their footing in this new commercial world in which all that was solid was melting, all that was sure was shaking and crumbling. Aristocrats tended to look at slaves as the last concrete things, along with livestock and land, and they held on tight. For a rising gentry that was doing well in this new expanding market, slaves become status symbols. Gentry women in Buenos Aires, merchant women in Buenos Aires wouldn't go to church, wouldn't go to mass without trailing a long parade of very well-dressed slave women and children behind them. In the U.S., the importance of slaves went well beyond the wealth generated from the cotton they picked in Mississippi or the cane they cut in Louisiana. The paradox of freedom and slavery was political and economic, but as I mentioned, it was also emotional. Capitalism, in many ways, was a massive project of ego formation, creating the modern self, notions of self-interest, inherent rights, notions of personal preference. And baked into that was slavery. Slavery made that possible in all sorts of ways, which we could talk about during the discussion. The way that this particular group of West Africans arrived in the Americas, in Montevideo and Rio de la Plata, they were literally brought into this orgy of corruption. Even though Spain had lowered tariffs and lowered taxes, merchants didn't want to pay any tariffs, any taxes, bringing in their slaves. Probably about half of the slaves brought into Montevideo weren't registered. They were brought in as contraband. This particular lot, or at least some of them, were actually bound for the Caribbean. They were on a Liverpool slaver, and they were intercepted by a French revolutionary pirate named Capitan Morday, who brought them into Montevideo. You know, pirates are often figured as proto-anarchists, sailing the ever-free sea, you know, in thrall to no man. But in this particular case, at least in Buenos Aires and Montevideo, they were vanguard capitalists, merchant capitalists. They would seize British goods, bring it into Montevideo, and by far the most valuable good was slaves. Morday brought thousands and thousands of slaves, and he was a partisan of the French Revolution. He believed in freedom, equality, and liberty. But at the same time, it catches something about the contradictions of the age of liberty that his involvement with the slave trade. You know, today, and as to Amasa Delano, as to the kind of narrative that I tell and the tracing Amasa Delano, Amasa Delano was in the Pacific as a sealer. He was sealing. I don't know what attracted Herman Melville to the Delano story. I speculated about the event itself, but the whole memoir is quite fascinating. Delano was, in his own words, in his own description, somebody who was created by the optimism of the American Revolution. He was born in Duxbury, Massachusetts, a town that was a hotbed of natural law liberalism and republicanism. Duxbury shed early on the kind of Calvinist gloom of predestination and embraced the idea, the proto-Unitarian idea that human nature was perfectible, that men can govern themselves, that they can use their virtues and their disciplines in order to tame their vices and appetites in order to govern themselves and govern their own society. That was the radicalism of republicanism in the 18th century. But if you read Delano's memoir, which he kind of wrote not only to get out of debt, because he was deeply in debt, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but because he believed it was adding to the great storehouse of knowledge. But if you actually read the memoir, it seems like less an encyclopedia of world knowledge than a series of fiascos and deceptions and botches and failures that point to the impossibility of knowledge or the impossibility of doing anything once that knowledge is acquired. His involvement in the trial episode is just one of the many episodes that reveal this, and I think that must have also caught Melville's eye. One thing that he was successful at, though, was sealing, at least for a very short time. Today, as we know, extractive capitalism has spread over our post-industrialized world with a predatory force that would shock even Karl Marx. From the mineral-rich Congo to the open pit mines of Guatemala, from Chile's until recently pristine Patagonia to the fracking fields of Pennsylvania, there's no crevice where some useful rock or liquid or gas can hide, no jungle forbidden enough to keep out the chainsaws or the oil rigs or the elephant killers, and no citadel-like glacier, no hard-baked shale that can't be cracked open, and no ocean that can't be poisoned. And Amasa, in a way, was there at the beginning. A ceiling represented one of the young American Republic's first experiences with boom-and-bust resource extraction beyond its borders. And a good way to think about ceiling is actually to contrast it with whaling and the way Melville talked about whaling in Moby Dick. Melville portrays whaling in that novel as the American industry. It's brutal and it's bloody, but it was also humanizing. Work on a whale ship required intense coordination and camaraderie among the crew. Out of the gruesomeness of the hunt, the peeling of the whale skin from its carcass, and the hellish boil of the blubber, something sublime, at least as Melville figured it, emerged, human solidarity and dignity among men of all races. Sealing was something else entirely. It called to mind not industrial solidarity, but settler colonialism, the isolation and violence of conquest and warfare. Sealers seized territory, fought one another to keep it, and pulled out what wealth they could as quickly as they could to leave their claims abandoned and empty and wasted. The process pitted desperate sailors against equally desperate captains in an as all-or-nothing system of labor relations as one could imagine. So with increasing frequency around the early 1790s, ships left New England, New London, Stonington, Boston, and headed towards that great archipelago of islands in the Atlantic off Argentina and in the Pacific off of Chile. They were on the hunt for a certain kind of fur seal that has a velvety down coat underneath a layer of coarse hair. And it was just in the early 1790s that artisans figured out a technique for extracting the down from the coarseness, from the coarse fur, intact. And a market, a very vibrant seal skin market, developed in Canton in China. Seals were killed by the millions and with a shocking casualness. And again, you know, a contrast with whalings, the danger and of the open sea hunt for a whale created respect among its pursuers for the prey. But the exact opposite happened with seals. They were just clubbed by the millions. Mountains of skinned and reeking carcasses piled up and sands on these islands and the beaches ran with torrents of blood. The killing was unceasing and continuing on to the light. Bonfires were created by the skin carcasses of the seals were used to fire the bonfires. And at times, penguins and other sea animals were birds and animals were used as wicks to keep and kindling to keep the fire going. And this massive kill-off took place not for something primal and needed by everybody, like light and fire that whale oil provided, but it was used for this new demand of a market economy. It was seal fur was harvested to warm the wealthy and meet a demand created by this new phase of capitalism, conspicuous consumption. Pelts were used for ladies' capes and coats and muffs and mittens, gentlemen's waistcoats. Elephant seals on these islands would be taken for their oil in even more horrific manner when they stood up and opened their mouths to bellow. Their blubber would quiver. It was kind of an index of their market worth. Hunters would toss rocks into their mouth and immobilize them and then stab them with these long lances. And seal elephants have very high circulatory systems when they're out of water, and they would just gush from these multiple piercings, almost like Saint Sebastian. At first, the frenetic pace of killing didn't matter. There were so many seals, rookery after rookery on island after island. There were millions of seals. And Amasa was there for the boom. His very first skinning expedition was in the 1790s, and he was also there for the bust. His second one, after he did well on the first one, he built a second ship to accompany the Pilgrim, which was to accompany his ship on the Perseverance, and his brother Samuel was put in charge. And they headed out in 1803, and this was the voyage where it would encounter their trial. And by this point, the rookeries were disappearing. Within just a few years, sealers had taken so many seals out off of these islands and brought them to China that they couldn't fit in Canton's warehouses. The market was saturated. Prices were plummeting. The seals were left to rot in the rain on the dock. They began to pile up in mountains. And as the prices began to fall, the only thing that the sealers could do was to accelerate the killing to make up the margin until there was nothing left to kill. And it was this way that oversupply and extinction went hand in hand. And in the process, cooperation that existed among sealers during the flush years, during the early years in the 1790s, had given way to bloody battle over pitched battles over islands, over territory, over thinning rookeries. And as money dried up, so did the authority that captains had over their labor. Delano's second voyage, when he left out, which I just mentioned, which he started out in 1803, first headed for Tasmania, for Australia, because he heard seals were thick there, but there were none left. His men deserted because there was no money to make. He wound up having to take on a crew of escaped convicts from a British penal colony in Tasmania. He got into these pitched battles with other sealers on islands in Bass Straits, which separates Tasmania from the Australia mainland, from the Big Island. He eventually gave up and started heading back to Chile to see if there was any seals then. His men began to grouse. They began to conspire. Delano began to have to use more and more physical punishment in order to maintain his authority. So it's at this point that a comparison between the historical Captain Delano and the fictional Captain Ahab actually might clarify things and illuminate just what I think is important about Amasa Delano. Over the years, Ahab has come to represent unhinged American power. There's this great scene in Oliver Stone's Platoon where the sergeant, the homicidal, genocidal sergeant, after slaughtering a village of innocent Vietnamese, one of his underlings said, "He's our Ahab." More recently, Edward Said called George Bush Ahab, or his insane and crazed and obsessive hunt for Saddam Hussein and neoconservative foreign policy equated to the arrogance and hubris that is embodied in that novel. And then Ahab also has also through the 20th century, particularly during the Cold War, come to symbolize a kind of totalitarian power in which he's able to pull his men into his emotional orbit through magnetism, through charisma, and getting them to join in this crazed hunt that will bring him and his men and all around him to disaster. And he came to symbolize a Hitler or a Stalin that's able to use the seductions of ideology in order to sway the masses. But Ahab, in many ways, isn't. Ahab is a rebel. He's actually not a good indicator of power. He violates, all of his action violates economic rationality. There's a great scene in Moby Dick where Starbuck, his mate, says, you know, this pursuit of Moby Dick, this pursuit of the white whale, is going to harm the economic interests of the Pequod's owners. And then Ahab's response is, owners, what cares Ahab about owners, about the owners? Let them stand on the Nantucket beach and howl into the typhoon. I really don't care. I don't know if he said, I really don't care. I added that, but I really don't give whatever. And, it's not rebels like Ahab or totalitarians like Ahab that are world destroyers, that are either at the time or now bringing the world to the blink. It's more people like Amasa Delano who follows the rules, right, who's on the front line of resource extraction. If Ahab is an exception, Amasa Delano is the rule. His authority is rooted not in charisma or emotional bonds, but a more modern and common form of power, the control of labor, hierarchical labor relations, and the conversion of diminishing natural resources into marketable items. And as seals disappeared, so did his authority. Until that is, he came across the Spanish slaver. Delano might have been personally opposed to slavery, yet once he realized he had been played for a fool, he organized his men to retake the slave ship and violently pacify the rebels. And in extremely gruesome ways, the men used the sealing lances that they, or the skinning lances that they used to skin seals to disembowel some of the more recalcitrant rebels. So caught in the pincers of supply and demand and trapped in this vortex of ecological destruction with no seals left to kill and no money to be made and his own crew on the brink of mutiny, Delano rallies his men in pursuit, not in pursuit of a metaphysical white whale, but actually existing black rebels. And in the process, he reestablishes his fraying authority. Now, I'd just like to end with a discussion about what exactly is the empire of necessity and what is the pursuit of freedom. Melville used the phrase empire of necessity in an epigraph that he had for a short story that he published around the time of Benito Sereno. It's this wonderful phrase, seeking to conquer a larger liberty, man but extends the empire of necessity. Now, Melville scholars tend to think that he wrote that phrase himself, even though he attributed it to it's an epigraph, and he attributes to it an unpublished manuscript in the author's possession. I think it was a way of saying what he wanted to say and then citing some unnamed authority. But whatever the case, Melville believed in universal freedom, but he refused an idea of freedom that defined itself as the opposite of slavery. As he grew older, he increasingly criticized what he described as a vile liberty that had taken hold in America. And he came up with this description on the centenary of the American Revolution in 1876, a vile liberty with reverence for naught, not for God, not for nature, not for others. And I think that this is what he was getting at with the phrase empire of necessity and with the larger saying, seeking to conquer a larger liberty, man but extends the empire of necessity. The idea conveys forward motion. It hints that that it's not the paradox of freedom and slavery that's the problem, but rather the denial of the paradox, the inability to see the paradox, like Amasa on board the trial, watching the Spaniard and the West African and not being able to see what was what. That the problem was America's ceaseless bids to escape the paradox, to believe that it was truly free, not just not a slave, but free of the master-slave relationship that Hegel identifies as key for evolution, for the evolution of consciousness. The problem is America's ceaseless attempts to slip out of the shackles of history, which only serve to deepen old entanglements and create new necessities. The way, for example, the opening of the West didn't solve the problem of slavery, but actually deepened it. Or the way the rise of free trade promised and still promises that if men were set free to pursue their self-interest, an ever more harmonious world would result. And experience has proven otherwise. I mean, in the United States today, a purer, or perhaps a better word is perverse, ideal of freedom has come to hold sway, at least among some. It's based not just on the fantasy of free trade and small government, but also on a more primal animus, an individual supremacy that not only denies the necessities that bind people together, but resents any reminders of those necessities. Herman Melville spent nearly his whole writing career considering the problem of freedom and slavery, but he often did so elliptically, intent seemingly on disentangling the particularities of disentangling the experience of bondage from the particularities of skin color, economics, or geography. He rarely wrote about slavery as an actual existing historical institution with victims and victimizers, but rather as an existential or philosophical condition common to all. Benito Sereno is one exception, and a particularly powerful exception. But even here, Melville, by forcing the reader to adopt the perspective of Amasa Delano, is concerned less with exposing specific social horrors than with revealing slavery's foundational deception. Not just the fantasy that some men were natural slaves, but that others could be absolutely free. There's a sense reading the story that Melville knew, or at least he feared, that the fantasy wouldn't end. That after abolition, if abolition ever came, it would adapt itself to new circumstances, becoming even more elusive and even more entrenched in human affairs. And I think that this is awareness and this dread is what makes Benito Sereno such an enduring story. There's also a sense that Melville identified in Amasa Delano the emergence of a new kind of racism, based not on religious or philosophical doctrine, but on the psychic need to define one's absolute freedom in opposition to another's absolute slavishness. This was a racism that was born in chattel slavery, but it didn't die in chattel slavery. Instead, it evolved in today's cult of individual supremacy, which, try as it might, can't shake off its white supremacist roots. In his memoir, the historical Amasa Delano uses a great term, now obsolete, called a horse market. And he uses it to describe the explosive pile-up, a convergence of currents, three or four currents crashing into each other that's strong enough to scuttle vessels. It's a good metaphor, and that's what the people on board the trial were caught in, a horse market of crashing historical currents, free trade, empire, slavery, and ecological exhaustion, destruction. I think it's also a good metaphor for ourselves, still caught in many of those currents. The different routes that led all involved into the drama in the Pacific reveal the fullness of the paradox of freedom and slavery in America, so perversive it could trap not just slaves and slavers, but men who thought they were neither. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Now we get the fireside chat part.
Yeah.
Can you guys bring up the house lights a tiny bit so we can see some of these beautiful people? And tell if they start to snooze, then we can pick up the energy. thank you, Greg. I think your talk is a challenge for us to think more about the current moment and the reverberations of these stories and themes. So even though you've done a lot of that, I want to push you further to bring some of these revelations up to date. The part that strikes me, in part because I'm doing work on the frenzy of extreme resource extraction today, is your extraordinarily powerful descriptions of the sealing industry. And this, it speaks in such a clarion way to the current moment, where at a time when we realize that the era of cheap energy that built our modern world and the consumer economy is coming to an end, you know, rather than coming to grips with that and trying to refashion our economies and cultures for a low energy path, we're going after harder, dirtier, more dangerous, more toxic energy. Tar sands, deep sea drilling, mountaintop removal, fracking. And, you know, they're the energy, the most powerful industry on Earth is coming up with ever new technologies. What can you tell us about the dawn of that kind of insane resource extraction frenzy that might give us a better understanding or a better way of seeing today's around energy, particularly in terms of like how do these systems come to an end and where are the pressure points for human agency in terms of how we bring this craziness to an end?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes they come to an end with collapse, right? I mean, just either economic collapse or ecological collapse. In the case of sealing, what's so powerful about the sealing example and being the very first case of resource extraction of the New Republic is that it was both. It was both oversupply, so the bubble bursted, and it could only absorb so many pelts and make so many capes and whatnot, and the seals just disappeared. And you just saw this, I mean, I just related some of the violence, but I think it's from collapse. Sealing was obviously not the first resource extraction in the Americas. The whole project of the Americas was resource extraction, the gold and silver from Potosí, from these great mines, mm-hmm. right, which become the world's universe first gold monetary standard, mm-hmm. monetized the world, and so built on slave labor. And I don't know when it comes to an end. I mean, in some ways, these are bubbles within a bubble. And I guess we're waiting. And what your wonderful work on is looking at the bigger bubble, how the whole bubble is about to come down, because it's just unsustainable. It's unsustainable.
In this sense, your riff about the empire of necessity, what Melville was trying to say about that, that maybe you know, it's a little too easy to say there's a paradox at the heart of the Age of Reason when, you know, equality was going to be born of, you know, bringing reason to bear on the world. And, you know, you have a sentence like, or a phrase like, all men are created equal. It's kind of like a bit of a big problem there.
Right.
In the formation of these, you know, foundational statements of rational liberty. But you're saying that it was not just that paradox, but the blindness to it.
I think that
Delano's inability to see the lie at the heart of the system.
Yes, I think that that's ultimately what my argument would be and what I believe that Melville was getting at, that the problem isn't the paradox, it's the refusal to see it. And it reveals itself in very concrete ways. I know that's a very abstract way of thinking about things, but we could bring it down to the concrete and look at the difference in political cultures between the United States and Latin America. And in Latin America, where there was more of an acknowledgement because of the different colonial models, because of the different experiences of way slavery took shape and whatnot, which we could talk about, and that was less of a fetish of freedom and more of an awareness of interdependency. And I think that that's manifest in very concrete ways in a culture of social democracy, a belief that citizenship entails social rights, positive rights, education, and health care. Right. I mean, embedded
in the Constitution.
Embedded into the DNA of Latin. I mean, and obviously in practice, it's come up short.
Right.
But it never gets expunged, no matter how hard. The Washington Consensus and neoliberalism in some ways, it was an economic policy, but it was also a great moral attempt at a moral revolution to get Latin America on board with the Reformation,
individualism,
and to expunge this social democratic tradition, and you compare it to the United States and the fetish of individual rights, the fetish of liberal democracy, in which somebody like Rand Paul could say that healthcare, if you believe in the right to healthcare, you believe what you're saying is that you believe in slavery. Mm-hmm. It's a crazy statement, but I think that there's I think that there's these roots that hang from that is what I'm trying to get at in this story. And the implicit comparison is why this culture of social democracy emerges, which I talk about in the footnotes in Latin America, and an embrace of social rights, and in the United States this denial of social rights. It's almost like, and this goes back, and to bring it back to abstraction, the United States isn't the paradox, but it won't enter into the dialectic. It's too, Amasa Delano is too dense to enter into the dialectic that Hegel says is necessary to get to evolve human consciousness. And the thing about Latin America and its social democratic tradition is it can't be extinguished, or so far it hasn't been extinguished. To bring it back to practical politics, there's problems with every one of the left governments, which we could all catalog, but they do represent a political culture that at least starts with the premise that it is the state's right, the state's responsibility to ensure some kind of social justice, and citizenship is predicated on social rights. And so when social scientists and political scientists like to talk about Latin America, there's one question. They talk about a lot of things, but the one question that runs through all of their assumptions is what accounts for the fragility of democracy in Latin America and what can we do to strengthen it? That question is exactly backwards.
Right.
It's what accounts for the strength of democracy or the social democratic ideal, right, and why hasn't it been extinguished?
How can we stop screwing with
it? Yeah, and what accounts for its endurance? And despite the violence, what other region had such an unbelievable amount of repression directed at it for such a sustained period of time that targeted the secular and left and the religious humanists, and yet didn't lead to a kind of particular extremism or religious fundamentalism, but that kind of social democratic humanism comes back with a vengeance. It's really remarkable.
You don't get into it deeply in the book, but I know that it's something that has seized your imagination, the role of slavery in the construction of the modern personality and in the hyper-individualism, the construction of the consumer mentality. And I'd love it if you could explore that a little bit more, because it strikes me that this moment that you focus on, which for Americans is a revelation that, our image of slavery is the plantation. In fact, there was this previous history of slavery in the Americas, right. which was totally different in the way that it was run by the Spanish.
Right.
And not to say that it was better, it was different.
Right.
But you start in this moment where the notion of free trade as a way to demobilize the revolutionary expressions that are coming out of the United States, out of France, that free trade is the answer.
The Spanish,
free trade in blacks is going to be the right. way that they hang on to their dying empire, and that there's something in this, the commodification of human beings that began with buying and selling them,
right.
but you know, has eventually evolved into our self commodification as
yeah.
market animals, as yeah. consumers defined that way. Like, just like, if, can you explore a little bit how that took place?
In
between then and now,
okay.
and I'll give you 35 seconds.
Okay.
If you just like the end of Democracy Now, where Amy asks
the
big question, and you got 10 seconds.
And the credits start to roll. Well, as I mentioned in the talk, capitalism, other people have talked about capitalism, is not just an economic system. It's this massive process of ego formation. And what I mean by that, it creates the modern self. It creates the sense of the notion of the notion. It generalizes among the population attributes that really the gentry or the aristocracy only had privilege to and claims to. This notion of dignity, of individualism, of preference, of the pursuit of self-interest. And I think that what I tried to do in the book is just show how slavery is baked into it in very real ways. And the spread of consumer culture in Latin America during this moment of free trade slavery, the slaves were coming in with French combs and Parisian perfume
right.
and patent leather shoes from Madrid, and so all of these
of the
consumer items. So it's not just labor. And what I was trying to get at was slavery as this psychic system and this emotional investment that people had in slaves, and why race is so inescapable. Right? Ultimately, slavery, basically, free trade in slaves takes that primal deception that I talked about, and acts as a force multiplier and insinuates it into every aspect of society, every aspect of social relation.
Mm-hmm.
It's in consumerism, it's in medicine, it's in law, it's in religion. It's in agriculture, it's in everything. And you know, in very concrete ways, the way slavery underwrote the expansion of finance and banking and insurance and ideas of risk. And, you know, it's just, you know, I guess I always knew that slavery created the modern world, but that phrase seemed very abstract to me until I started doing research for the book and trying to tie in these narratives. And just
Greg has been writing an extraordinary little series of spin-off pieces, some of which have been in Tom Dispatch. One was in the New York Times. One was in The Nation.
One Nation.
Where he's exploring some of the ways in which slavery directly formed, like modern medicine in your most
yeah.
recent one. And I think it's a really important extrapolation of
yeah.
these ideas.
So for modern medicine, slave ships weren't just floating tombs because of the high mortality rate. They offered surgeons and doctors an opportunity to theorize about the causes of disease, the symptoms, how they present themselves, the best treatment. They were floating laboratories, and because slavers made no proprietary claims on the intellectual property generated by slavery, that knowledge disseminated very quickly through the larger medical community. So what we know about trachoma, for instance, comes out of slaves going blind on the Middle Passage, and you know, basic medical knowledge about the spread and treatment of disease. And then also, slaves were also key. So slaves were primary victims of smallpox, but they were also in some ways instrumental in its eradication. When they came up with a live vaccine for eradicating smallpox, the Spanish king ordered that every subject in the Americas be inoculated, but they didn't have the resources to carry out such an ambitious campaign. So what doctors did was they transported the live vaccine in the arms of slaves that were being transported from one region to another to be sold. So you would make an incision, insert some pox and pus in which the vaccine would incubate, and then after 10 days when it began to superate, you would take that pus and then transfer it to another arm. So it was through the institution of slavery that Spanish America eradicated smallpox.
I think one of the things that makes this a really appealing study is because at the heart of it is a slave revolt. as well as this supremely postmodern pantomime that you sketch so well. In fact, the slaves on the trial first asked to be taken to a black republic that they'd heard about. And you write really powerfully, although briefly, about the role of the Haitian Revolution in the imagination of this time. And I think there's been a lot of scholarship that you know better than we do about the significance of that first successful slave rebellion and the formation of the republic.
When people talked about, up until recently, up until a decade ago or 15 years ago, when people talked about the Age of Revolution, they meant France and the United States and maybe Spanish America. They tended to leave out Haiti, right? The Second Republic in the Americas, the only nation ever born out of a slave republic that in some ways forced the contradictions that I talked about liberty and property and humans as commodity into the open. Haiti declares its independence in 1804, right around the time that this is happening, this event is happening, which allows me to peg it to this unbelievably important moment in the Age of Revolution. And one of the things that the West Africans ask for before they ask to be turned to West Africa is to be brought to a land that they heard of blacks that exist in these waters. Now, there's a lot of scholarship about the silencing of the Haitian Revolution. Now, scholars didn't pay attention to the Haitian Revolution. And there's a great book by Michel Rouf-Triot, an historical anthropologist, called Silence and the Production of History, or Silencing the Past. And no better illustration of that is Benito Cedeño's response to the request of these rebels to be brought to a land of blacks that they heard exist in these waters. He says, no such land exists. And that's when they asked to be...
Land run by black people? No. Right. I haven't heard of it. Yeah.
And Haiti becomes this very powerful example, an object lesson in the promise of the Enlightenment and the Age of Revolution for other slaves. From the Hudson Valley, slaves in Herman Melville's family were involved in a series of arson attempts that almost burned Albany to the ground in 1793. They were inspired by Haiti down into Montevideo. There was, you know, it just spread. So there's ways in which Haiti was an object lesson, but it was also a very concrete, in concrete terms, helped bring about the end of slavery. It drove out Napoleon's troops in 1803, and Napoleon was trying to restore slavery on the island.
Which set off a cascade.
It set off a cascade of things. Napoleon had imagined Haiti being the anchor of a restored French empire coming down the Mississippi Valley that would contain the United States, restore sugar production, which would generate wealth. When that dream ended, largely because of Haiti, Napoleon turned on the old European aristocratic class, and he went after the Bourbons in Portugal and Spain, and basically set off a series of events that would lead to Spanish American independence and the end of slavery in the Americas. So there's
one of the ideas in the book that most lit up the present for me was your extraordinary contrast of Amasa Delano and Ahab, and your argument that the authoritarian inspiring figure is not actually responsible for the majority of damage. And you know, you equate Ahab with various historical figures, but Bush and his quest to revenge daddy's humiliation and all of that with Saddam Hussein really strikes a chord. When you're saying, what I want to ask you sort of frontally is, you're talking about the perils of centrism, I think, of the rule, the ones that don't have the grand vision, that believe that the system must be maintained, who will go against their own professed ideals, like being against slavery, right, and then taking revenge on slaves who have the audacity to break the rules and rise up, right, for whom the system itself is more important than the ideals that might inform it.
Yes.
Someone who might come to power and take previous policies, imperial and warlike policies, and double down on them, a surveillance state that gets deeper and more insidious with the passing of time. Someone who might embrace an all-of-the-above energy strategy that brings oil production in the United States to its highest level ever, and exports coal from the Powder River Basin to poison people in other lands.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you are prepared to, how far you're prepared to go.
Well, I was very prepared. I had this whole section. that I did make the equation that, there's almost an evolution from Ahab. It's not just that they're contrasted. Ahab is tumultuous and tortured, and Amasa is placid and corporate-like.
No drama, Amasa.
No drama, Amasa. And you could go back to different moments in the history of the U.S. Empire. That Andrew Jackson, Indian killer, expansionist, war maker. He was a maniac, and his emotional turmoil was on display for everybody to see. You get to Franklin Pierce in the 1850s when Herman Melville's writing Benito Sereno, and there's a cheeriness to him and an emptiness, even though he dies of cirrhosis of the liver because he's an alcoholic, something's going on. But he basically is this, he's this sunny optimist that puts into place policies which deepen the crisis over slavery, particularly expansion. Mm-hmm. One could take those examples and think of the evolution of not George Bush, maybe we can go back to Lyndon Johnson, who wore his anguish on his sleeve and seemed to be almost Shakespearean in his inner turmoil. And then you have almost a kind of the placid-like exterior and intense discipline of Barack Obama, mm-hmm. who is presiding over many of the policies that are as destructive as you mentioned. I think there is, it's not just an opposition between Ahab and Amasa. I think you could argue that there are these moments of evolution from the turmoil to the placid that represent different faces of American empire.
And yet you see this, you can see this in Latin America and in the Americas in general, that there are periods of, I think less so in Latin America than in North America, but you have periods of conservative revolution followed by, you don't always get them followed by a progressive or leftist revolution to right the pendulum.
Right.
You sail into calmer waters for a while where the gains that the right has made are sort of consolidated.
Yeah.
We've certainly had that in Canada as the two old parties take turns.
Right.
So from a historical point of view, is there anything that we can learn about this pattern?
Well, in 2008, it did seem like the Reagan.
2008. Shouldn't we just think? Let's just take a moment. It was good.
Seem like the Reagan coalition was coming apart. You laid out a scenario that political scientists like to talk about when we talk about presidential power. There's a new coalition builder, whether it be FDR or Reagan, mm-hmm. that builds a new consensus out of the ruins of the past. And then there are a series of consolidators, and certainly Clinton was a consolidator of Reaganism in all sorts of ways, and Bush. But Bush, just like Lyndon B. Johnson, Lyndon Johnson tried to have it both ways. He tried to expand the New Deal at home and have war making abroad. That led to the collapse of the New Deal, the beginning of the end of the New Deal consensus and coalition. One thought that Bush was the end of the Reagan coalition because he tried to have both. He tried to have neoliberalism at home and expansive neoconservative militarism abroad, and then that would bring the whole thing down. And one imagined in 2008, 2009 that Barack Obama represented a new transitional moment, and even if it was unclear what it was. But in retrospect, it does seem that he's reestablished. He's reestablished he's reconstituted finance capital, and he's rationalized war making. There are different ways, of course, to think about it, right? There's also the question of race and the reaction to him. And I go back and forth between thinking, the corporate liberals are the enemy, to thinking, well, these other guys are really bad. They do represent a more revanchist, scary current within American political culture.
Just depends on where you are in the election cycle.
Yes.
Where your bile is really concentrated. Yeah. I can totally relate to this. I want to end talking a little bit about stories, because you can tell it's a fixation of mine these days. And you have an extraordinary gift for finding these small stories, like the story of Fordlandia, like this story aboard the trial that you describe and you trace, but there's a moment in your books where it just sort of time stops and the reader sort of becomes aware of all of these different historical forces being brought to bear on a moment. And when I think as a filmmaker, and I look at Naomi's work as a writer, and the challenge of trying to change the narratives on which our society is built, one of the things that I've learned in chasing this idea over the last few years is that actually it's an act of remembering as much as it is an act of creation. That a lot of the stories that sustained human life for a lot of humanity's history were about reciprocity, were about cooperation, weren't about triumph and conquest and the primacy of the individual. And I feel a sense of urgency, and I think a lot of people feel a sense of urgency about remembering those stories, whether they come from our own families, our grandparents who knew that you don't just throw stuff out and knew how to be prudent with limited resources, which the hyper-consumerism has tried to obliterate that consciousness, to the indigenous stories about how we sustain human life in constant interaction with the natural world, not a museum idea of nature, a constant exchange of resources where we harvest resources because we need to live on them, but we always put back when we take.
Right.
So as a historian who finds these little stories that seem to encapsulate things, have you thought about the stories that might give us an alternative narrative? And what place does that occupy in your own imagination?
Yeah, I mean, well, in some ways, that's what I tried to do with Fordlandia. I mean, it was within the terms of industrial capitalism, but trying to remember that there was this utopian moment of capitalism, you know, that somebody like Henry Ford could imagine and believe that he could balance and find sustainability between high wages, whether it be high wages and profit, or between rural communities and industrial cities. I mean, you know, that vision gets swept away by the forces Ford himself unleashes. So he was trying to at least excavate a utopian moment that seems to be lost, right, in this current iteration or stage that we're in of political economy. In this version, in this book, there's less alternative. You know, there's just these small moments. I mean, in some ways, the whole story of Amasa Delano and his memoir of trying to make good on the promise of individualism and his deep belief in self-creation,
which he maintains despite the evidence of his entire life story.
Until he doesn't, right? And that's why Delano is a much more of a tragic figure even than as I presented him here. He goes back. He's a failure. He's a complete failure, and he winds up indebted and broke and in debtor's prison, and he writes his memoir to get out of, to, you know, get the creditors off his back, which that doesn't work. But he also becomes very jaundiced about American power. What's interesting is, you know, there's two different expressions and experiences that I think people have when they engaged in violence and terror beyond America's borders. And you could think about the new left and the new right coming home from Vietnam. One doubles down on certainty, on fundamentalism, on a commitment to the project. And one, if they don't become political, become skeptical and jaundiced. That's exactly what happens with Amasa Delano and his brother Samuel. His brother Samuel, who's also involved in this episode and other episodes of race violence, comes back and he sheds all of that optimism of that proto-Unitarianism and embraces a hellfire Christ of damnation and visceral kind of experience and rejects the optimism of that budding Christianity of his childhood. And he becomes part of the Second Great Awakening and everything. Amasa Delano goes in the opposite direction. His early kind of pluralism, in which he was actually quite sympathetic to other cultures, becomes very jaundiced and critical and skeptical about Christianity. He writes this amazing letter to his brother right before he dies where he condemns Christians and Christianity, and he talks about, you know, basically dying, not knowing his own mind, and never will. It's this remarkable kind of split. And so I don't really have, to go back to your question, I don't really have an alternative vision of a more reciprocal society. But I think the whole book in some ways is about that, by trying to argue against the fetish of individualism and individual supremacy that emerges at this moment in a very deep and textural way. I mean, Amasa Delano dies completely broke. His probate estate is a 50-cent hammock, a worn hammock, threadbare hammock, a 50-cent old pine writing desk, and 700 unsold copies of his memoir. So it's
the writer's nightmare.
So it's an artifact. It's an artifact from his sailing life, an artifact from his writing life, and the unsold sum of both. So it really is.
So individualism ends in the remainder bin.
Yes,
I like that.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This was fun. Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.